Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
As I promised, I'm reaching back from time to time for some of my favorite episodes that I hope will provide a little relief from the grinding news of the day. Today I want to share a conversation I had in 2016 with Steve Kerr, the splendid coach of the Golden State Warriors. Steve has 8 championship rings as an NBA player and coach. 3 came on those immortal Chicago Bulls teams with Michael Jordan that is being featured in the current ESPN documentary series The Last Dance. But even if you don't enjoy sports, I think you'll enjoy this conversation because Steve is so much more than a great athlete and coach. Raised in part in the Middle East, he lost his father to assassination in Lebanon and is one of the most thoughtful, interesting people I've had a chance to sit down with. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. I read a column that some columnist wrote in October saying Steve Kerr should run for president of the United States. And I was thinking about the negative ad, you know, Steve Kerr, born in Lebanon, raised among Muslims in Egypt. Yeah. Is he really an American?
right.
And so on. But I don't think most people know about your journey and where and how you grew up. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I've been incredibly lucky in my life to live the way I have, to grow up in the family that I grew up in. As you said, born in Beirut. My dad was teaching at the American University in Beirut at the time, and he was a Middle East political science professor. Ultimately took a job at UCLA, and we moved there when I was just a year or two old, and spent most of my childhood in Los Angeles. But my dad would take sabbaticals, so we spent time in France, Tunisia, 3 years in Egypt. And while we were living overseas, we would travel as well in the summertime. So I really, you know, got my education from traveling around the world, living in different cultures, and there's probably no better education than that. So
What did you learn from it? What did you learn about those countries and cultures, and what did you learn about ours?
Well, it was interesting because Cairo was the biggest influence on me because I was junior high school age. And that was late 70s. Americans were beloved in Egypt. I couldn't walk down the street in Cairo without somebody rubbing my blonde hair and smiling. But we were a group of Americans that were there with kids from all over the world. I went to an American school. CAC was the name of it, Cairo American College. It was in the outskirts of Cairo in a suburb called Mahdi. And I had friends from literally all over the world. The American kids were mostly oil companies, diplomats, kids, or academics like my mom and dad. But we met kids from everywhere. We interacted with them. A lot of different languages were spoken at the school. I actually learned Arabic halfway decently. I could get around.
Did you?
And, you know, we would do all kinds of incredible stuff that nobody else would have had the chance to do.
And how much contact did you have with Egyptians when you were there?
Lots, because there was a big Egyptian population at the school, and the sports teams that I played on, we would play against Egyptian schools and club teams.
You were a basketball player from
an early age?
Yeah, I played everything growing up. Back then, everybody, you know, you just played whatever sport was in season. Mm-hmm. And now it's so different. You play the same sport year-round. But so I played some soccer and baseball and football and basketball. But basketball was always my favorite. And I really fell in love with it at UCLA when my dad was a professor.
Not a bad spot for it.
Not bad. Yeah. John Wooden, heyday. You know, my earliest memory of a UCLA game was when Bill Walton was playing there.
Yeah.
It was 1972, I believe. They played, they were number one in the country. Every game was electric, sold out. The student section was incredible. The band, it was heaven. I walked in the first time and I couldn't believe, and I fell in love with it. And I'll never forget, I don't remember anything about the game except for walking out with my dad, and UCLA had beaten Maryland. Maryland was number two in the country with John Lucas. They had Len Elmore.
Yeah.
Yep. They had another guy, Tom McMillan, maybe?
No, McMillan was at Columbia.
He went to Columbia. Okay. Yeah. They had another guy who played in the NBA. Anyway, UCLA fans were so spoiled. They had won seven straight national titles. And I walk out, and UCLA had won by like 2 points. And I'm walking with my dad, and the guy next to me says, "What is wrong with our team?" And the guy next to him says, "I don't know. We're not like we were last year." And he starts ripping into Walton or for doing that. And I turn to my dad. I said, "Dad, we won." He goes, "Yeah, but the expectations are a little higher than that."
Probably a pretty good lesson for winning 73 games and not winning the championship.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there were people who were saying the same thing.
For but, sure. That's part of it. But those are good problems to have.
Yeah, high-class problems. Yeah. You know, when I was a student at the University of Chicago, my roommate went to Providence College when Marvin Barnes and Ernie DeGregorio were there, and they were in the Final Four, and his parents had a relationship with Providence, and they gave us these tickets to go to the Final Four. And we hitchhiked down from Chicago to games at the Checker Dome in St. Louis, which was this old barn.
Yeah.
And in that final game, Bill Walton, that was the game where he had against, I guess, Memphis State, Larry Keenan and those guys, 21 of 22 he hit.
Yeah.
And it was maybe the most – I mean, I watched Michael Jordan for 13 years in Chicago.
Yeah.
That was maybe the most perfect game I'd ever seen anybody play. He had a bunch of assists.
Yeah.
His baskets were mostly jump shots and bank shots.
He couldn't dunk back then. So he had to lay it in. I remember watching the game on TV.
Yeah.
Was that 72?
73.
Yeah. So I was, you know, 7, 8 years old. But that was the reason I fell in love with basketball, was growing up in that environment. And then my parents would send me to John Wooden basketball camp in the summer, and just absolutely fell in love with it. And what an era to grow up in as a sports fan.
Walton was on this podcast and talked about stealing, not stealing, but Wooden told him, "You can't be involved in anti-war sit-ins. Just write a letter and express yourself on this." So he went down to the coach's office and got a sheet of paper with Wooden. It was Wooden stationery. The secretary gave it to him, and he wrote a letter calling Nixon a war criminal and asking him to resign on John Wooden stationery, and got all the other players to sign it.
Yeah.
And Wooden was not amused by.
So he said, "Forget the letter. Why don't you go out to Wilshire Boulevard?" And I remember the scene of Walton sitting on Wilshire Boulevard yelling at Chuck Young, the chancellor of UCLA. And there was a great documentary on HBO probably 10, 12 years ago. It was about the UCLA dynasty, and it dealt a lot with that Vietnam era and the protest and the dichotomy that Wooden presented as this iconic figure kind of cut straight out of the 50s.
Yes.
And with this incredibly virtuous way, coaching this group of players in the midst of the Vietnam War who were kind of, you know, trying to figure out how the world worked. And Wooden was just an amazing figure for so many reasons. But I highly recommend that documentary.
Well, what's extraordinary is everybody loved – I mean, his players revered him.
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Walton was the ultimate renegade.
Right.
And he revered John Wooden till the day John Wooden died.
Yeah.
So he still talks about him reverentially.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little more about politics and sports, but I just want to return to your years overseas and ask you. I mean, there are two ways it works. One is you get an appreciation for other cultures, but you also get an appreciation for how other cultures see the United States.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm interested in that angle as well.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about America living overseas?
Well, I saw poverty up close. I mean, we lived in a nice suburb, but everywhere you went in Cairo at the time, you'd see poor people living on the streets. There was an entire community. I'm trying to remember the name of the suburb of Cairo that basically was called the City of the Dead, because it was people who lived basically in this cemetery and underneath these mausoleums. And we saw this every day, and we'd see beggars, you know, asking for bakshish. You know, that was the word, you know, for you know, can I have some money? Can I have something? We saw this every single day, and it struck me because, you know, growing up in Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles, you know, going to UCLA campus for basketball games, I didn't see any of that. I did, you know, I was a, you know, middle class kid growing up in a wonderful environment. So I saw poverty. A lot of people see it in our country, but I never saw it in our country. I saw it there. But I also saw a totally different way of life. I saw kids playing soccer on the street with two rocks as the goal and a bundled up rag for a ball. But I saw people, as I said, from all over the world. People were so nice to us. Americans, as I said, were beloved. And my parents had this really eclectic group of friends, so we had barbecues all the time, people from all over the world. And it taught me about other cultures. It taught me about compassion and understanding that, you know, everybody grows up in a different environment. We all see the world differently. And so I think it made me more compassionate, and it also made me appreciate our own country for not only the comforts of the freedom that we lived in, but just for the joy that we were allowed every day. A lot of, you know, most people don't grow up with great joy in their lives. They're just struggling to survive. And that struck me pretty hard at a young age.
Your dad went back to Lebanon to become president of the American University in Beirut, and had a tragic end there. Talk about that and what happened, and how did you find out about it?
Well,
why did he go back? By the way,
well, he grew up in Lebanon. His parents were missionaries after World War I. They went to Turkey and Armenia. They helped with a Armenian orphanage, and they were relief workers. And during the Turkish-Armenian Holocaust, and you know, once the war ended, they traveled. They ended up in Beirut. I think some of the orphanages that they helped were in Lebanon, across the border, and so they fell in love with Lebanon and settled there. Then they became employees at the American University. My grandfather was a chemistry professor. My grandmother was the dean of women. And they raised their family there. So my dad was born and raised in Beirut, went to boarding school on the East Coast, Deerfield, and went to Princeton, and but went back to AUB where he met my mom. My mom was on her junior year abroad from Occidental College, and that's where they met. And so it's an incredible story. But his dream job, once he became a professor at UCLA, his dream job was always to go back and be the president of the American University in Beirut. So when he finally had the opportunity, he took it despite
It was at a very tumultuous time.
It was, yeah. And for the most part, you know, up until that time, the university had been kind of an oasis. There had been problems at the embassy and you know, with any military presence. You know, there was a lot of fear at the time. But the university up until the early 80s had been pretty much left alone. But just before and as he took the job, his predecessor was kidnapped. And so, you know, he had already taken the job. He didn't want to back out. He spent the first, I think, 9 months or so on the job in New York while the political circumstances quieted down. And then he ultimately went there. And I was there with him and my mom and my younger brother. My younger brother was a freshman in high school, so he went to live with them. I was heading off to University of Arizona as a freshman. And so I went to stay there for about a week and to see the campus. And that would have been in August of 83. And he was assassinated in January of 84. So he was only on campus for, you know, 4 months.
Was he worried? Was he frightened going back?
He was. You know, my sister tells a story about spending a night with my dad in a hotel in New York before he went over there, and he expressed his fear to her. He didn't say much to the rest of us, and I think also we had.
She's older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had that typical sort of. Insulation when nothing bad has ever happened to you. You think, oh, it's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen to us. And so we had some of that, I think. And my dad was beloved in the Middle East. He spoke fluent Arabic. He was a champion for the Palestinian cause. If anything, we were a little more worried about right-wing Israeli politics than anything going on in Lebanon. I remember when I was about in eighth grade, our car in Pacific Palisades was firebombed by a right-wing zealot with the Jewish Defense League. So we had an experience of fear, but it just, it wasn't something that caused us to say, this is really dangerous. It was more like, we think he'll be okay. He thought he was going to be okay. Again, he grew up there. He spoke fluent Arabic.
Was
he a
target simply because he was an American? I mean, this was 2 years after the Marine barracks was.
I don't even think it was 2 years after. I think it was 2 months after.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that happened in October of 83.
Could be, yes.
Yeah.
That could be right.
And the embassy had been bombed. Somewhere in that time as well. And so all this stuff was now going on around the city. And, yeah, we were absolutely concerned. But when he first took the job, we were sort of probably disillusioned.
Was your mom over there with him?
She went with him when he left, when he took over on campus for good, which was August of 83. So my mom, my younger brother, and I all went. I stayed for about a week just to visit, and then I went off to college. And that was a story in and of itself. It took me 3 days to get out of the country because of shelling and that was going on during the Civil War. I mean, you look back on it and you go, my God, what the hell were we doing there? And it's hard to explain. But at the time, I think my dad felt relatively safe and insulated because of his experience there, because of how many friends he had in the community. And because he was part of the university, which, as I said, was educating thousands of prominent Arabs from all over the Middle East, and so we felt like he was somewhat safe, and obviously he wasn't.
You got a call at school.
I got a call January 18th. A friend who worked at the university, a man named Vahi Simonian, good Armenian name. Our family has this incredible Armenian connection because of the work my grandparents did. I still have Armenian people come up to me to this day all over the country and say, thank you for your grandparents' work. It's really a source of pride for our family. But Mr. Simonian worked at the university, a good family friend, and he called me in the middle of the night. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning in my dorm and gave me the news.
And I mean, this is, I don't mean to, it's got to be a very painful memory. Were you surprised when you heard the news, or was it? You knew that he was vulnerable, but you had this sense that it would be okay.
I had a sense that it was going to be okay. But again, you look back on it, the Marine barracks were bombed in October. 2-3 months before, I think over 300 Marines were killed. It was
right.
Devastating. The embassy had been bombed. So there was danger, but again, there's that sort of innocent sort of shield of protection that we all kind of think we have until something horrible happens, and then you realize, oh my God, and it's too late. But it was a really difficult situation. My dad wanted to be there. It was his dream job. He wanted to help people there. He loved that university, and he was in heaven while he was doing his job, but it only lasted a few months.
And were you 18, 19?
I was 18, freshman, yeah.
And you guys, I read somewhere that he was very much your counselor on the whole basketball thing, where to go to school. He was like an advocate for you.
Yeah, he was. I only had two scholarship offers out of high school, and both came late in the summer at the last second. It was Arizona and Cal State Fullerton, and he helped me because Arizona kind of stopped calling me, and I thought they had pulled the scholarship. I didn't even know if they were going to offer one, actually.
Lute Olson, the classic great college basketball coach, was the coach at the time.
He was just in his first year, and the program was in shambles, and he had an extra scholarship, and he saw me play in a summer league in L.A. late that summer, and he kind of offered me a scholarship at the last second, but there was some confusion, and my dad kind of stepped in and called everybody on both sides and, you know, wanted to get the lay of the land, and he asked me where I wanted to go, and I said, it's not even close. I want to go to Arizona. And so he called Lute directly and said, what's going on? Do you have a scholarship or not? We're kind of confused. And Lute said, oh, yeah, we do. And I think Lute may have been considering somebody else. And because I really wasn't – honestly, I was not that good. This is not false modesty. I was a kind of a late bloomer. But he helped kind of facilitate it, and I ended up getting the scholarship at the last second. And he came and visited me on campus in October. Maybe it was early November. We were practicing and scrimmaging and stuff, and he spent a couple nights in my dorm with me. And so it was nice to at least have him there. He never saw me play a game, but he got to visit me on campus. And that was
you know, I lost my own father suddenly when I was a sophomore in college, mm-hmm. and the thing that was hardest for me was not having an opportunity to sort of say goodbye and express those things that, you know, you kind of take for mm-hmm. granted. But I also kind of felt all of a sudden like that was a line of demarcation between being a kid and growing up.
Yeah, for sure. I felt that way too. And there were lots of things that I thought about afterwards. You know, I didn't give him a hug when he left, you know. And he I remember he left my dorm room, and in typical Kerr fashion, he left two of his suits in my closet. It runs in the family. I leave stuff all the time now. Yeah. And he came back 15 minutes later, and that was the last time I saw him, and I didn't give him a hug, you know. And it bothers me to this day. I didn't say goodbye. And I think about him all the time, because what's happened in my career is so far-fetched. It really is. Like, you know, I was just hoping I could actually get in the rotation at Arizona and play, you know, maybe for a couple of years and earn some playing time, and to end up having this career and not being able to share any of it with him, he would have just loved every second of it, and I would have loved sharing it with him.
I can't tell you how much I identify with that, you know, because I think my dad, who was an immigrant, would have been stunned that I ended up working for the President of the United States.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, those are that's the pain, or not knowing your family and not knowing your kids, and it's tough. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. You've seen the Middle East kind of explode recently. First of all, was it? I read somewhere there was a forerunner of Hezbollah that was suspected in your dad's assassination.
Iranian ties. We actually ended up suing the Iranian government. It would have been about 2002 in Washington, D.C. They didn't, you know, nobody showed up from their side. It was more, as my brother called it, it was free therapy. You know, mm-hmm. we all got to get up on the stand and talk about how much it, you know, hurt us. But it was basically Hezbollah, and it was it was done because of he was the most prominent American in the city, and he was killed only because of his nationality being American. And it was ironic because he had spent his whole life helping Arabs and helping trying to foster peace in the Middle East. And that was his entire area of focus.
But that may have been in some ways also an impetus, because perhaps the most dangerous people were the ones who could build bridges.
Sure. It was like Yitzhak Rabin.
Exactly. The single most since someone killed the Archduke Ferdinand, probably the single most meaningful assassination on the globe was that of Yitzhak Rabin, and for just the same
Yeah, for trying to foster peace. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. You mentioned your brother. Your brother was on the National Security Council under the Clinton administration.
Yeah.
Did he go? What led him to that career? I want to talk about all your successful siblings and ask what the heck happened to you.
My mom will be thrilled. Every time somebody asks my mom about me, she says, "Let me tell you about Steve's siblings." She's very proud of all of us.
Yeah, and deservedly so. Well, but did some of these experiences lead your brother into an interest in national security?
Yeah, I think so. He went to University of Arizona, and then he ended up at Thunderbird Business School in Phoenix. But he got a job. It was a low level job in the NSC. But he was right there in the Situation Room, and he worked with a lot of people who were right in the mix. President Clinton wouldn't have really recognized him, but I'll never forget when we played the Bullets. I was with the Bulls. It would have been, I think, 96. We went to Washington, and President Clinton came in our locker room, and he was so prepped for every meeting. He knew everything about everybody. So somebody in his prep team told him that my brother worked in the National Security Council. And so he came up to my locker, and he said, "Steve, your brother Andrew's doing such a fine job for it." My brother said he would have no idea who I was. Andrew was there for I think 4 or 5 years. I may be wrong on that, but it was great. Every time we'd come to town, he would take our team on a tour of the White House. And back then, it was so easy to walk through. You just walked through one metal detector. And Tony Kukoc, who a Croatian teammate in Chicago, one time we were standing in the Oval Office with my brother, about five of us on this tour. And he said, "I cannot believe this." He said, "In my home country, I couldn't even come within one block of the presidential palace, and here I am standing in the president's office." And it was a great symbol of American freedom.
Yeah, yeah. You have a sister who's active in politics in Britain?
Yeah, in England. Her husband is a professor at Cambridge, and she's a local politician, kind of like what city council would be here. And then my older brother is a professor at Michigan State in agricultural economics, whatever that is. I always tell him whatever that means. But he does a lot of work overseas. He travels everywhere. He does research on third world agriculture and the economy and how different cultures can help make the best use of their resources. And if you ask me anything more about it, I wouldn't know. But he does a lot of important stuff.
People. Well, it seems like it. And with climate change and everything, that's becoming even a more significant and important area to study. So, what would you have done? You have this. I'm a Bulls season ticket holder. Have been for 40 years. So I saw you hit a lot of shots, and you have a preternatural 3-point shot. Still, are you the leader, or you're one of the leaders in the history of the NBA?
Yeah, in terms of percentage, and that's that was kind of my game. And I played on a lot of great teams, so I got a lot of open shots. So
yes.
I was blessed playing with Michael and Scottie Pippen, Tim Duncan, David Robinson. I was blessed. And the best thing for me was I played for Hall of Fame coaches. I played for Lute Olson, Lenny Wilkins, Cotton Fitzsimmons, Greg Popovich, and Phil Jackson, who are really two incredible mentors for me, along with Lute. And going to John Wooden basketball camp. Like if anybody ever wanted to coach and they wanted to say, "All right, I want a mentoring process," You could look at my career, and that would be the blueprint. I mean, it's amazing that I was able to play under all these incredible coaches.
And you talk about each of them had a very distinct personality. You talk about Jackson and Popovich, arguably the two, among the top five coaches of all time in the NBA. What'd you learn from them?
I learned perspective. Life perspective. One of the things that happens when you become a professional athlete is it consumes you. And it's one of the reasons a lot of people make it. It's all-consuming, and if you're competitive and you're passionate about it, then you're going to attack it, and that's why you work so hard at it. That's why you make it. But then you're there, and you're consumed by it, and every little detail can bother you if you're self-conscious at all. And what I learned from those guys was, take the game. You know, Phil had it was like a Zen quote. It was something to the effect that, you know, treat your job every day as if the fate of the world depended on it, but know that it really doesn't mean a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. And I wasn't eloquent enough with that statement, but that was the point of what he tried to do with us was focus on what you're doing, attack it, work at it, but we're playing basketball. You know,
right.
This is a sport. This has got to be fun. And Phil and Pop both had wonderful senses of humor. And so humor was a big part of their coaching styles. And Pop was so similar to Phil in his perspective, but totally different in his approach and the way he coached. But both of them made these huge impacts on me and on my coaching style and on my life. And what really connected them, even though they're very different human beings, it was their interest in other things besides basketball. Phil had this fascination with Native American history and spirituality, and he incorporated that into his coaching. Pop has this great fascination with politics and the military.
He was in the Air Force, and he was an intelligence officer in the Air Force for 5 years before he turned to basketball.
Exactly. And you go into Pop's office, he's got CNN on. And I'm not just saying that because you work there.
A man of impeccable taste.
That's right. But meaning he doesn't have ESPN on. He's got politics on.
I have to tell you, just to interject, that the funny thing is when we were when we would travel with the president and he was campaigning, he insisted that we not have any news on that. He always had ESPN on.
Yeah.
Probably for the same reason.
Right. You want to get away from what consumes your life.
Right.
But that was a big thing for me to start my coaching career, to have learned that perspective how can you teach your players that, man, this is important to play together as a team, to sacrifice, to work, and to try to win. But, man, this doesn't mean anything. You know, go home to your family and spend time with your family and take them out to dinner and enjoy your kids. And so that balance, can you find that balance? And that's what I try to do as a coach.
Yeah. I remember from those years that Phil used to, when you guys went off on your what they call the circus tour, because the United Center was booked for the circus and you'd be gone for quite a long time, usually to the West Coast, he would give you all books to read. Do you remember some of the books that he gave you?
He tried to give people books based on their background. And he knew that I had gone to University of Arizona, and I had a home in Tucson at the time. And so he gave me some Cormac McCarthy books, All the Pretty Horses he gave me, and he gave me some Tony Hillerman books. They were Southwest-based novels, mysteries. But it was really great what he did. He kind of gave different books to different people based on what he thought.
It's really interesting because – I've managed other things, not sports teams, but the ability to identify those things that are unique in people and appreciate them seems like a really important quality in a coach. And choosing the appropriate book for people certainly reflects that. Now, did you read the books?
Oh, yeah.
And did your teammates?
Some of them. Just depended. Some guys did, some guys didn't.
I want to know what books Dennis Rodman was reading.
Gosh, what did Phil give him? I should remember this because I remember it was a topic. We were wondering the same thing. What's Phil going to give Dennis? I can't remember. But Phil never, he didn't give us like book reports or anything.
He just,
if we read them, great. If not, it was his way of showing his compassion and his care for us. And it's what made him, it's what made Popovich a great coach. It went way beyond anything about basketball. It was about his compassion and care for you as a human being.
Yeah, I remember I was in the pavilion. This was before you got to the Bulls, the first time they won a championship, and mayor or somebody invited me to be there. And the parade wasn't anything like the Cubs parade we just had in Chicago, but it was pretty wild, and fans were reaching for other players, and Phil stood by the door as each player came in to ask him if they were okay, because he was worried that they were getting manhandled by the crowd. And it struck me that what a filial role he was playing. You know, mentioning the Cubs, and then I want to move on and ask you about Michael Jordan and playing with Michael Jordan. Newly designated Medal of Freedom winner, I see. He's going to pick that up next week from the president. But the Cubs, as you know, a kind of epic drought, 108 years between world championships. And Joe Maddon is the manager who came in the last 2 years. And when, it strikes me that he's a lot like the personalities that you're talking about. And he said someone told me he never talks about winning. And I asked him about that. He said, yeah, because winning, everybody wants to win. But when, if you think just about winning and losing, it just makes you tight. So I say focus on process. Do those things that, you know, you need to do. And it'll either work or it won't work. He had an extraordinarily young team that performed at a very high level, and they didn't seem to feel pressure. And I think it has a lot to do with the way he managed
Agreed. I'm a huge Maddon fan. I went and saw him this past summer in San Diego. That's where I live in the off season. And my son's a huge Cubs fan because he grew up in Chicago, and I'd take him to Wrigley all the time. So my son has been in heavy. He's 24 now, and it's the season for every Cubs fan, right?
Yes.
It's just an incredible year. So he and I went and sat with Joe Maddon. It's one of the benefits of my job. I have access to, you know, dugouts and locker rooms.
Yeah.
So I went and wanted to pick his brain. And it's one of the things that really attracted me to Joe is exactly what you talked about, process over result, and make the process interesting, right? He's got like pajama days. They travel in onesies, and he's a little nuts. He's a little crazy.
He is.
And Phil was a little crazy, you know, and in a good way. You make it fun. You make it interesting. Take the pressure off. And maybe the best thing I learned that night when I was in that locker room was I went across to the other locker room, and the Padres and I met Andy Green, really young guy. Great guy. I said, he asked me about Maddon. And I said, yeah, it was really fun talking with him. He said, you know what I love about Maddon? He plays music in the clubhouse, win or lose.
Right.
And he said, most owners would walk into that locker room after a loss and hear music and go, why are they listening to music? They just lost. They should be angry. There's kind of this unwritten rule in sports that if you lose, you have to be despondent.
Mournful, yes.
Yes, mournful. And most managers, most coaches, and I shouldn't say most, but a lot of them coach out of fear because it's an incredible job and it pays really well. But if you can lose it so quickly, people get fired, you know, less than a year in if things don't go well. So a lot of coaches coach out of fear. Phil never did. Maddon does not coach out of fear. He doesn't care if the owner walks in and they're playing music after a loss, because he knows it's good for the players, especially in baseball. A great team is going to lose 70 games, right?
Yeah.
They go 92-70 and win the division. Well, that's 70 times when you've lost. But Andy Green was marveling at the fact that Maddon just didn't care about all these sort of norms and sort of expected behavior. And so every day, as you said, was not about the results. It was about the process. They'd play music. They'd have fun. They'd joke around. They'd do these pajama parties on the road. He'd bring in like zoo animals to the clubhouse before a game.
Right.
And
he had a magician. They had a 5-game losing streak, and he brought a magician into the clubhouse to entertain the team before the next game, which they won.
Which they won. Phil used to burn incense in our locker room after a 2-game losing streak. We got to get the evil spirits out of the locker room. That stuff is great. It just keeps it entertaining and loose, and it focuses on the process. And everybody, no matter what job they do, I think they're going to do better with it if they're enjoying the process.
You know? Yeah. I want to ask you about Michael Jordan. When I had Bill Walton on the podcast, I tried to get him to answer this question, but he didn't really – I don't think he absorbed the question, because it seems so kind of – hard to fathom to him. I said, how do people – all you guys in the NBA There's so many talented, physically talented people. It seems to me that the people who separate out in every sport are the people who react differently to pressure and who are able to elevate their game when the pressure ratchets up. Mm-hmm. Like Jordan always used to say, well, the game slows down mm-hmm. for me. What is it about the really special players? And you've got some of them on your team, Curry
yeah.
and others.
Yeah.
What is it about really special athletes that allow them to
perform under
yeah.
pressure? Yeah, and not everybody does. I was a player who felt the pressure early in my career and tightened up, and then sort of figured it out later in my career and loosened up and realized you really do have to say, screw it, just, you know, go out and play and go for it, and whatever happens, happens. But I was pretty self-conscious as a young player. Some guys have never felt that way in their life. Steph Curry has never been self-conscious about a shot in his life. And it's
That's
wonderful.
That's apparent, by the way.
Yes. And it's a wonderful quality, and yeah. one that you have to learn quickly as his coach, because he's going to take some lousy shots.
Yeah, but the percentages are on your side.
Yeah, they are. And so you live with the lousy shots, understanding that it's part of who he is. It's part of what makes him who he is. He's fearless. And what's great about that is that, he doesn't worry about repercussions. You know, Michael never worried about what people were going to say after the fact. But there are a lot of players, like I said, myself included, early in my career, who were thinking about the repercussions and didn't want to be the GOAT and didn't want to screw up for the team and for the fans. And that's actually a conversation I had with Pete Carroll, Seahawks coach, about. And we both are huge fans of the book, The Inner Game of Tennis, which deals with this exact topic, your body and your mind. And that's what every athlete needs to do at the highest level, is integrate your body and your mind so that you use the knowledge that your brain has with the natural instinct that your body has. It's a hard thing to make come together. But there are some athletes like Steph who just do it naturally. Michael just did it naturally, and it's hard to explain.
I remember the one game, playoff game in the finals in Utah, where he stole the ball from Karl Malone at the end of the game. And he talked about it afterwards, and he had thought it all through. He said, I know they're going to go to him. I can come up on the blind side. And I will tell you, as a Bulls fan, we always thought we had a chance to win when he was on yeah. the court, because he would not let you guys lose. That yeah. he was so willful about winning, about just like dominating the game, that he would find a way.
We knew we were going to win because of him, because and he wasn't always the easiest teammate. You know,
he
was hard on everybody. He made every practice hard. He talked trash to everybody. His theory was, if you can't take the pressure from me in a practice, you're not going to be able to take the pressure of game 7 of the NBA Finals. So it wasn't always fun, but every one of us knew how dominant he was and how good he was, and we knew we were going to win every time out there on the, you know, especially in the playoffs. We just knew it was the ultimate comfort level. He was so dominant physically, but also emotionally on the floor. I think teams and players all over the league were intimidated.
Have you seen any player? I know LeBron James was obviously a big factor in what mm-hmm. happened, but with you guys last year. But is there any player who approaches Jordan in your?
I think LeBron comes close physically. There's this physical dominance with LeBron that's just palpable on the floor. You can feel his presence. Kobe, skill-wise, was similar. He'd hit these impossible shots.
And mindset-wise, he was a pretty
hard-minded
guy.
Ruthless. And from what I understand, similar teammate in terms of maybe it wasn't easy, but you had great faith in him. To me, Michael, sort of a combination of Kobe and LeBron. He had the skill set and the physical dominance. And he was undefeated in the finals. He never lost in the finals, 6-0. But I can't speak for the 60s and early 70s.
No, I'm just talking about in your experience.
Yeah, my experience. He's the greatest of all time.
And now a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
Mm-hmm.
You were very outspoken after this last election and very passionate about your concerns about Donald Trump, the campaign he ran, what the implications are. Why did you decide to speak out?
Because I was asked. You know, it's funny. I get people all the time who say, well, you know, stick to sports. You know, not to my face, but I'll read it, you know, maybe on Twitter or whatever. People, you know, I'll just hear maybe my family will say, yeah, so-and-so was saying you should stick to sports. But people ask us. So why shouldn't I answer, right? I have this forum. If there's something important to speak on, then I think we should speak on it. In this case, I felt it was important to address not the politics of the election, but the nature of the cycle of the election cycle. It's the first time in my life that the election was not about policy or even personality. It was about anger. It was about fear. And I was disgusted. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. People vote for all kinds of reasons, right? You vote for your pocketbook. You vote for abortion rights or gay marriage, or you vote for certain social policies or maybe foreign policy. Maybe you're worried about this or that. And that's what it should be about. You should vote based on policy. But this election had nothing to do with policy. It had to do with hatred and fear, and we had a candidate who stirred that up, and I thought it was a horrible precedent for our country.
You, we had this discussion earlier about your experience as a kid. There was an element of Islamophobia to that appeal, the notion of banning Muslims and so on. How much did your upbringing, your experience, inform your feelings about that? Because you seem very personally offended.
Yeah, it definitely influenced me because I did grow up in the Middle East for many years and made a lot of friends in Egypt. And I've got lots of friends now, American friends, who are from Lebanon, from anywhere in the Middle East. I go to a wonderful Middle Eastern restaurant in Portland every time we go there. And I've got these amazing friends who cook me my Lebanese food, and we hang out, and they're Lebanese origin. They're Americans. These are the people who Donald Trump is talking about in terms of, internment camps. Now, I shouldn't say that yet because I don't know if Trump has actually mentioned it, but
yeah,
it's being talked about in the circles. But the only reason it's being talked about is because of the nature of the political process that we've just been through. So it's personally offensive. It goes against everything.
Have you heard from some of your friends?
Yeah, I have.
Are they fearful?
I think people are genuinely fearful. I heard immediately, like within days of the election, and I think we all have heard stories of hate crimes, whether it's language or acts of hatred, that it seems to me that have been sort of justified by this process we've been through. If the president of the country can make remarks that are hateful and offensive, then it sort of rubber stamps it for a lot of people, and that's scary.
What about among the players that you lead? Is there has there been a reaction to the election?
Yeah, we talked the next day after the election as a team, and I remember I just asked the players, how'd you feel? And Steph Curry said, weird. I feel weird. I think that's how we all felt. It was weird. And as I said, who cares about, politics? It's decorum, right? It's a level of respect and dignity that should go along with this process that should set an example for everybody in this country. And there was none of that. And instead, we've sort of incited this fear and this hatred. And it is scary because there's a lot of talk about what's next, whether it's, suppressing freedom of speech with the media or internment camps for Muslims.
In fairness, that was a guy who was in the Trump camp. He, as you point out, he hasn't said
that. Yeah.
You mentioned that people say, well, stick to sports, don't talk. Right. Obviously, you're very fluent and thoughtful on a lot of things, and you have experiences that inform your point of view. So what should the role of people in sports be, or celebrities generally, in this discourse, and how much should people care?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And that's a common topic these days with, Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the anthem. And
Which you've been supportive of.
Yeah, I supported him because it's freedom of speech. And he's, I think he made his message more clear as he went, forward. He made clear that he wasn't trying to offend the military, that he was talking about equal rights. And I think that's important to – if you're going to speak out, you should know something about the issues. But this is an interesting time we're living in. Everybody has a voice, you know. The same people who are telling me stick to sports, they're tweeting, their own political comments, and they're, writing stuff on Facebook posts. And so we all have a voice now, and which is kind of on the one hand, it's good. Everyone should have a voice, but it gets a little scary when everybody's got their own opinion. And sometimes people are –
Well, there's no filter.
There's no filter, and there's no fact checking.
Yeah,
and that's a whole different topic, but it is an important one, and I think it's.
But does speak to the fact that we don't really have a unified discussion where we're discussing one set of facts about which you may have an opinion.
Sure.
If facts are sort of fungible, it kind of makes the whole thing much more difficult. And facts took a beating in this election.
It did, because then it becomes propaganda, and that's where it gets scary when there's propaganda involved rather than facts and genuine discourse. There's a bad historical preference precedent for that, obviously. So
now you're coaching in the Bay Area, so you're probably to the right of 70% of the people who come to your
that's right.
games. But
that's
did you get blowback from what you said?
I had lots of emails in my inbox, mostly positive, many negative, stick to sports, or thank you for speaking out. Again, people are interested in my opinion. I didn't offer this up. I've been asked many times during press conferences about this stuff, so people are interested, and so I don't hesitate to speak. I'm not the authority on any of this, but what I do feel strongly about is a level of respect that has to exist between candidates, but also between people. I've got lots of. I'm a Democrat. I've got lots of friends who are Republicans. We have really great, healthy conversations. There's a respect level. That's how it should be. Again, people voting on policy, absolutely. But the nature, the tenor of this election was ugly and nasty, and it's scary in terms of what direction that's going to take. Especially because we really don't know what Trump's presidency is going to look like, because he didn't really spell it out other than possible deportation and putting Hillary in jail, which I'm pretty sure he's not going to do that, but he said he would.
Right. The rolling back of the Health Care Act and a few other things.
Yeah, yeah. So we don't
know.
You're
right. And I think that's part of the anxiety is – we're beginning to see some appointments, but that's a story still in the making. What's next for you? How long do you see yourself? I don't want to create all kinds of jitters in the Bay Area here, but I mean, do you see yourself doing this work for many, many years, or
yourself
doing other stuff?
No, I love coaching. It's I feel like it's what I was meant to do. I come from a family.
You'd never coached before you got this gig.
No, I was in management with the Phoenix Suns for 3 years, but I did a lot of TV. I did 8 years of television commentary.
And great at it.
Thank you. Yeah. It was great for me as a father and a husband to be able to be at home a lot more. Once my kids got to college age, that's when I decided to go into coaching because we were done raising our kids and I could go off and do do what I really wanted. And coaching has always been in the back of my mind. But I love it, and I'm incredibly blessed. I coach this group of guys. My very first job in coaching is with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Andre Iguodala, and now Kevin Durant. And, you know, working with Bob Myers and an incredible ownership group for a team that has – amazing fan base, sell out every game. So I haven't seen the dark side of the NBA as a coach. And frankly, not really much as a player either. I've lived this wonderful ride on these great teams. So, but I love coaching, and it's something I'd like to do for a long time.
Well, you bring a great voice to all of us, not just sports, but I'm glad that you speak out. And you're right. I mean, the whole premise of this podcast is that we have to have more conversation and less shaking fists across a jagged divide. So,
that's right. Can I mention one other thing?
Yes.
Along those lines, I've been doing a lot of reading since the election, and I read – the best piece I read was a guy named David Wong on a website called Cracked, which I didn't know anything about, but somebody sent it to me. And it's if you're listening to this, you should read it. It's he's a guy who grew up in rural Illinois, and he basically explained – why what happened just happened.
Yes.
He moved to the city, became a writer. He said he became a Hillary supporter, but he said growing up, if he hadn't left his town, he for sure would have voted for Trump. And he explained all the reasons why, and he made so much sense.
Yes.
And it explained the divide that exists in our country, and it made me realize, yeah, I'm living a totally different life.
No, this
from
is a
so many
huge,
people.
Huge issue because we live and we have sorted ourselves in such a way that we don't hear each other.
Right.
And I happen to have a house in rural Michigan, and my neighbors all had Trump signs on their in their front yards, not lawns but yards, and they're good people, good neighbors, hardworking people, wonderful people. But they feel like they've been discarded.
They
feel like they've been dismissed and disrespected.
Disrespected. And then the other thing is that they feel as though the establishment has just sort of changed everything. And the establishment in this particular election was represented by the Democrats and by Hillary. And
Trump exploited that in clever and diabolical in some ways.
Yes, but he's right. In fact, you know, I thought the most poignant moment of the election was when he admitted that he hadn't paid his taxes because there's a loophole. He said, "Of course I didn't pay my taxes. There's a loophole that I used."
Right.
I thought that was so important because what really matters is not whether Hillary's in office or whether Trump's in office. What matters is can we actually fix the system? Can we get rid of campaign financing? Can we get rid of, you know, tax loopholes for corporations? Can we actually do something to generate jobs in this country? And I don't know if the answer is yes. That's what's scary. I think we may be so far down that path. And can we actually – because the history of the world is that the people who have money influence the politics.
Well, I think beyond that, we live in these revolutionary times when technology is
–
you can't replace an NBA player with a machine.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of jobs that can be replaced and are being replaced, and that's only going to accelerate, and more people are going to find themselves in the position of having had a good job and not being able to find something to replace it. This is the biggest challenge that
I
we
agree.
Face, and we got to – if we don't address it in a serious way and frankly, this campaign should have been all about that.
Yeah, it should have. But it makes no difference, though, who's in office when it comes to technological advancement. I mean, it's only a matter of time before automatic cars and trucks are in. So what happens to the trucking industry, right?
Exactly.
And I don't know how many tens of thousands of jobs there are in the trucking industry.
3 million people drive for a living in this country.
All right. So
what happens to them in the economy?
What happens to them? And does it matter who wins a presidential election? Because you can't suppress
what does invention. Matter is, do we have a strategy? Do we think is it front and center to say where are these people going in our
where
economy?
Are they
how
work?
Do we create opportunity for them? Because as you know, it's not just a matter of a paycheck. It's because we can give people money.
Right.
It's a matter of dignity, self-worth, how people define themselves.
Right.
So these are big, weighty issues. And if we don't get it right, then this kind of right-wing populism is going to take root. Trump won. You see it in Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll see more of it. So there are a lot of
scary,
a lot of issues. So maybe you should run for president.
Greg Popovich for president. I would vote for him. I really would.
Steve Kurtz, great to be with you.
Right.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.